it's hard to stay calm as a member of the tech sector on this particular point. But if you look at the absolute numbers and you look at how businesses grow and how we will, to my mind, ever be able to compete with the huge platform and scale businesses that we see coming from the US, we have to have a deep and talent-based relationship in the tech sector with Europe. The entire European tech sector, which is its absolute peak, is still only 7% of the US's tech sector. 7%.
President Trump handed another legal defeat. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco on Thursday unanimously upholding a lower court's decision to block Trump's controversial executive order that temporarily banned travelers from seven Muslim-majority countries and all refugees. Trump tweeting minutes after the ruling in all caps, "See you in court. The security of our nation is at stake.
We have a crime problem. I wish the rise that we're seeing in crime in America today were some sort of aberration or a blip. My best judgment, having been involved in criminal law enforcement for many years, is that this is a dangerous, permanent trend that places the health and safety of the American people at risk. We will deploy the talents and abilities of the Department of Justice in the most effective way possible to confront this rise in crime and to protect the people of our country."
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. It is Friday. It's February 10th, 2017, 5:10 in the morning. Glad to have you along for another edition of The Opening Bell, another business day. It is our last business day of the week, Friday. We have lots to talk about today on the show. Later in the program, we'll visit with Rick Cini from faircompare.com, talk more about that historic flight to the longest flight ever by a jetliner. It was the Boeing 777. We'll talk to him about why that's probably not a good idea to be on a plane that long. And also, we'll have some cheap fare to get you out of town, maybe someplace warm. And soon, Paul Nolte will join us for our weekly Friday conversation. But first, on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning, Dow futures pointing toward a positive open on Wall Street later this morning, up 22 points. The S&P and NASDAQ futures are just a little bit higher as well. Crude oil is trading up almost 1% this morning, 53 a barrel. In Europe, most of the indices, generally the big ones, are higher, with the exception of the CAC. The FTSE is up, so is the DAX. Other markets are lower. The story in Asia, markets are generally higher, after led by big gains there after U.S. President Donald Trump promised he would soon cut taxes for businesses. That announcement said yesterday, a big announcement coming forthcoming in the coming weeks, but no details offered on that yesterday. In a meeting with airline and airport executives, though, Mr. Trump vowed to roll back government regulations, said he would announce a plan in the next 3 weeks to reduce taxes for businesses. The comments were short on details, but still encouraged investors not only in Japan and around the world, but here in the United States. Yesterday on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials rose about 118 points. The Standard & Poor's was up as well. The NASDAQ was up also about 32 points, or about 0.5% yesterday. The dollar's flat against the yen, down against the euro. Benchmark U.S. crude oil rose to $53.50 a barrel, now at 53.53 now a barrel. Asian numbers, by the way, as the Nikkei closes up 471 points, almost 2.5%. Some news that you may have missed overnight. Delta Airlines says it plans to hire as many as 25,000 workers over the next 5 years. The CEO says that the Atlanta-based company is growing its ranks and expands, and upgrades are coming for hubs at several of the nation's airports, and they're going to need those employees. The 25,000 figure includes a combination of growth and backfilling attrition. Delta didn't specifically say what the breakdown would be. Delta has about 80,000 employees currently. It is reasonable to expect the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates 3 times this year. That's according to Chicago Fed President Charles Evans, a voter on policy this year, telling reporters yesterday there is uncertainty, but in his words, it's got a particular direction to it in terms of economic stimulus, and that direction is up, he said, of fiscal policies. Good place to bring in Paul Nolte now of Kingsview Asset Management with us every Friday, our portfolio manager. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Steve.
Were you at the Evans Rubber Chicken event yesterday?
He was with the CFA Society yesterday, and I took a pass on it. I've seen him talk a couple times in the past, and he's generally been very cautious about monetary policy, willing to allow interest rates to hang around very low levels for a longer period of time. So for him to make that shift, and it's a subtle shift, is important. And certainly this time he's a voting member, whereas over the last couple of years he has not been.
And so if he's normally been dovish, would this put him as a hawk now, three interest rates? Or
it puts him in line with where everybody else is. And I think what the common thought is that the Fed will be raising rates. And we will be hearing more over the next couple of weeks, because now that the Fed is done with their meeting, they all go to all corners of the United States and make their comments about what they think monetary policy should be. And everybody is, for the most part, singing off the same playbook or songbook that we're going to have three rate hikes this year.
And are the bookies giving us a date yet? Is it looks like May?
Not yet. I'm thinking it'll be the last half of the first half of the year, so probably May, June. And again, it's going to depend on how monetary policy has been through Bernanke's term and Yellen's, very data dependent. You know, we talked about four last year. We got one. We're not certain that we're going to see that, but we are seeing interest rates at the short end pick up a little bit. Interest rates, interestingly enough, at the long end, so 10 years on out, have actually come down a little bit, because inflation really hasn't been a problem, and that's really been the driving factor for long-term rates. So we're seeing a flattening of the yield curve, which historically has not been good for the U.S. economy.
We're hearing sort of anecdotally from people that we've been interviewing this week for the show and getting ready for next week that here, at least in Chicago, contracts for new homes is way, way up over the last month. And if that's the case, it may signal that people are taking the Fed seriously and getting ready to put down money on a house.
You know, when you take a look at the Mortgage Bankers Association, you take a look at their numbers, actually they've been kind of flat. So new purchases, refinancing activity and stuff like that has been on the flattish side. We've seen mortgage rates actually, after ticking up earlier, have actually started to back off a little bit. So, again, when interest rates do start rising, and when just after they announced in December, you do see a flurry of activity because people are like, oh, my gosh, you know, I better hurry up now. But that tends to dissipate rather quickly.
And we also see the Super Bowl seems to be, realtors always say Super Bowl weekend is the weekend people start.
Yeah, because it's going to take a couple months to get things through the system. And certainly when you start taking a look at homes, for a lot of families especially, you want to get into the place sometime in late spring, early summer for the fall school season.
Paul Nolte of Kingsview Asset Management. He's a senior portfolio manager there with us every Friday here on The Opening Bell. We'll continue our pre-dawn business conversation with Paul.
From ABC News, Wall Street Now, investors staged a surge on Thursday, pushing the Dow Jones 118 points higher to finish at 20,172. The Standard & Poor's 500 picked up 13 points. The Nasdaq climbed 33 to a record high, 5715. L.L. Bean's famous free shipping policy could change. The outerwear company based in Maine says it needs to lower costs because too many customers are taking advantage of its generous return policy. L.L. Bean is also offering its employees voluntary early retirement packages. The parent company of Pizza Hut plans a shakeup. Yum! Brand says sales at Pizza Hut fell 4% in the U.S. last year, so it'll place renewed emphasis on its delivery service rather than its sit-down restaurants. Even President Trump's late-night tweets haven't been enough to attract new Twitter users. The social media site plans to change its advertising strategy and focus more on video ads. That could attract more big-name sponsors. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program, 522. Paul Nolte of Kingsview Asset Management is in with us, as he is every Friday at this time. Paul, just one question from our Twitter feed this morning. It's one that we've talked a little bit about this week with the Dodd-Frank potential rollbacks, the review that's going on right now, and this has to do with the financial advisor rule that may be under review. Is that something that could possibly be taken back, and should people be concerned about that?
You know, it's going to be interesting because we're so far down the road with this right now. To roll it all back, we've seen all the investment firms put out new share classes of the different mutual funds to adhere to the new fiduciary rules. So for them to roll that all back tomorrow, is something really that a lot of the firms are saying, you know, we're already there, so no need to roll that back. I think where they're going to pull back on from a regulatory perspective is, again, some of the fee issues and some of the other regulations that are costing banks a fair amount of just filing costs and so on to be compliant with the law, which will reduce some of the regulatory burden.
It's one of those things where, and this may be the case at Kingsview, but this is something that companies generally do ethically anyway. You're in my corner, right?
Well, yes and no. Remember that you have to ask your advisor how he gets paid. Most financial advisors do it on a fee basis. So it's generally a percentage of asset as a management fee. A lot of brokers get paid commission. So it's based on the product that you buy. So if you buy an annuity or you buy some of these mutual funds, these different share class mutual funds, they get paid a commission on the purchase of that. So it's in. So you have to ask yourself, what's your role in this? So as I tell my clients, I'm on the same side of the table as you. I want your assets to grow because then my income grows. Whereas a broker is going to get paid on a commission, so it's based on whatever he sells you, and that is where it may or may not be in your best interest. So that's really the heart of the issue.
Let's talk a little bit about earnings. The one that I've been hearing a lot about this week is Twitter. I guess a lot of people I know have Twitter stock. They're a little concerned after this poor showing. User growth is just completely horrible compared to Facebook.
And it's, you know, they did not get the Trump bump,
right,
that a lot of people thought they were going to see. And they're having a real hard time, as was mentioned before, in trying to monetize the popularity and get advertisers, et cetera. I don't follow Twitter. I don't have a Twitter account. I do have a Facebook account. So it's when you take a look at social media, it moves very quickly. And right now, at least, depending on your age, depends on what social media you're using. Mm-hmm. So the older you are, the more likely you are to use Facebook. The younger you are, you might be using something else, a Spotify or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. There's still quite a few people that use Twitter. I'm a Twitter person, and I can't imagine not having it. And people I've talked to say the same thing. And then I read this week that they're considering, one of the things that's being considered is turning it over to a nonprofit to run as just sort of a nonprofit thing for people to have, like a news organization almost.
I think it is a nonprofit already, and that's part of the issue.
Good point. Any other earnings that have concerned you this week?
You know, when you take a look at the earnings, and I'll take it out a little bit, when we take a look at the earnings landscape, and one of the things that a lot of people are talking about now, at least, is we have earnings estimates for the end of the year and even into next year, and the earnings are expected to be growing at 15% this year. Historically, what we see is a lot of analysts dial that down. So instead of 15% growth now, a year from now, as we get closer to that year period, so as we get to October, November, and look at December as opposed to from February or March, those numbers tend to come down a lot. So instead of $120 earnings per share, we may see $112, $115. So when people talk about forward earnings estimates, those are generally always inflated. And part of the reason why I take a look at where are we today on the real earnings as opposed to trying to project forward.
This also, we've talked in the past about how you shouldn't be looking at your portfolio all the time, and this notion of being a patient investor. What does that mean?
You know, and the last year has been a perfect example of that. We worried about Brexit. We worried about the election, and the markets moved fairly dramatically around those events that, you know, this is going to be earth-shattering type of news, and we should be trading on it and making big adjustments to the portfolio. And really, it's paid to have a very good plan, well-designed to start with, and stick with that plan. Make some adjustments along the way, but not a wholesale dump everything. I'm going, you know, put it all into a jar and bury it in the backyard. So when we take a look at emerging markets, and we've talked about it for the last year, emerging markets, have done relatively well to the U.S. markets. They look very good today. They came back after the election, declined significantly, but have recovered since then. So as long as the fundamentals are in place, give it some time. It's not going to be a straight line up. You're going to get some bumps along the way. But again, you'll do better in the long run as opposed to trying to chase the latest trend or try to avoid the next impending doom, because there's always something on the horizon that's going to, you know, doom us all at this point, whether it's Brexit, the election, or something else.
Or a 3 a.m. tweet against your favorite company. So we won't see you again until after Valentine's Day. Are you doing something special with the missus?
Absolutely. We'll be going out to dinner, I'm sure. And actually, we're taking off to see kids. I'm going one direction. She's going another direction. So that'll be our last get-together for probably a week or so.
Split it up there. Nice. So, Paul, good of you to come in as always, and we'll see you next week.
Absolutely. Nice to be with you again.
From ABC News Tech Trends, I'm Alex Stone, a possible solution for cell signal crunch.
We need more capacity ASAP.
AT&T says it's begun working on a plan that could one day result in 5G data speeds. To do it, the company is using a device called AirGig, which is put on top of existing power poles and converts tiny radio waves that travel along power lines into cell signal. AT&T's radio access engineering director says customers will see results right away.
Customer will feel immediately that the signal quality is much better.
AT&T's chief technology officer says it's a first-of-its-kind solution.
This is a radical new approach delivering multi-gigabit speeds.
The company also says it's a relatively cheap way to bump up data speeds. It's working with Access Architecture and Analytics to install the units. VP Hank Kafka.
Take this into areas where fiber may not yet be deployed, and it could be very expensive to deploy fiber, bury new cables.
With Tech Trends, I'm Alex Stone, ABC News.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the program on our Friday edition of The Opening Bell. President Trump met yesterday with CEOs of the biggest airlines in the U.S., including Chicago-based United Airlines, Delta, Southwest, American, all there. The president telling the CEOs that the White House, the Trump administration, is going to do all it can to help their industries.
We want the traveling public to have the greatest customer service with an absolute minimum of delays and with the greatest convenience, all at the lowest possible cost. We want to help you realize these goals, and we will indeed help you realize these goals. Airports, very important to me. Travel, very important to me.
President Trump yesterday at the White House with the CEOs of the airlines. It wasn't clear if the CEOs raised their concerns as they had planned with the president about the immigration ban and the travel ban. Mr. Trump told them that he thinks the federal administration, aviation administration, should be headed by a pilot. He also says he hears airline systems are, in his words, out of whack, and that he hopes to improve technology when it comes to airlines. This past week, the world's longest commercial flight landed in New Zealand. It was Monday. The arrival of Qatar Airways, 14,535 kilometer to Doha to Auckland. It was 16 hours and 23 minutes. A flight QR920 arrived about 5 minutes ahead of schedule. We thought we'd talk about this morning with Rick Cini of FairCompare.com. He's the founder and CEO of FairCompare. You can follow him on Twitter at Rick Cini. Rick, good morning. This was a pretty big deal for the airline, Qatar Airways. Talk to us a little bit about what they accomplished.
Yeah, so it's been always sort of the holy grail of actually having the absolute longest flight. It's not that easy to do. Essentially, you have to do that without refueling in the air like some of the military jets do. But typically, this would have been a race between the Dreamliner, the 787, which has fairly long range, and the 777, which has huge tanks. So this particular flight, we're looking at flight times in the 17 to 18 hour range for the longest flight that you can actually be in there and still have some reserve to make sure you can land properly at your destination.
Flight QR920 landed 5 minutes ahead of schedule, 16 hours and 23 minutes.
That's 8,800 miles. It's a long way.
Yeah, and at first when I heard this story and didn't know it was a 777, I thought immediately of the Dreamliner. Are these? So tell us a little bit more about the competition between these two. Which one do you think is going to win out?
Well, the difference is that the Dreamliner has a lot less seats available to it. It has a little more interesting flight module. It lets you go from different places where you typically would only fly a 777 between huge airports, for example. And in the case of a Dreamliner, we've even seen them deploy them in places like Austin, Texas, flying into Europe, for example. So it gives them a lot more flexibility, a lot more range. You're usually around just under 300 passengers as opposed to 400 and some odd passengers in some cases. So it's just kind of a different sort of aircraft, and it more reflects the ability of some of the medium-sized to larger cities to actually have nonstop flights, long-haul nonstop flights, compared to some of the huge metro cities.
It brings up a good question, though, and that is when you're on one of these really long flights, hopefully not a 17-hour flight, but a real long flight, what is it that passengers should know about how they should behave and what are the health problems?
Yeah, no, there's all sorts of interesting things around sleep patterns. There's, making sure you get up and move around a little bit. There's potential blood clots in your legs, an area which you have to be aware of. You know, just doing anything where you're sort of sitting around for that long a time. These aircraft tend to be a little more roomy. They have, in the case of the Dreamliner and the new 777s, a little more areas around it. The lighting is actually done in such a way where they've changed the lighting all throughout the actual travel period to try to adjust you to things. But you definitely need to get up, move around, make sure you're actually, moving that blood around a little bit from time to time. And you'll see people on these long-haul flights doing calisthenics next to the bulkhead doors, and it's a good idea, actually.
Yeah, when I went to Tokyo on a trip, it took forever to get there. I remember I was back in steerage, and it was probably the worst trip of my life. I can't imagine being on a 17-hour flight. What is your record?
Yeah, so typically what I do, and I go to Asia from time to time, I like to actually stop in California, usually find a cheaper flight anyway out of there, spend the night, take that flight the next day. It sort of breaks it up a little bit. When you have those long flights that are in the 13 to 16-hour range, it's actually better to get off the plane, for example, have a connection. I know everybody wants to get there quickly, but in some cases, it's actually better to stop. And if you have kids, it's even heading out to Europe, it's actually not a bad idea to stop on the coast as well. I know everybody wants to get there quickly. And usually you save a bit of money that way as well.
Rick, everybody's starting to think, I think, of summer vacations, spring vacations. What is the time period that we should have in mind, and what are your pointers?
Well, a couple of different things. First of all, if you're shopping for spring break, you haven't purchased that ticket, just add about $5 to your virtual airline ticket every day you wait. You're getting to the point where a lot of those flights are starting to fill up, and you're going to see those prices rise dramatically. But if you're looking outside of that, as we head into towards Easter time frame and in early April and maybe even later May, as we head towards the last part of spring and into early summer, you should start shopping in the next month or so and looking for those tickets. Now, domestically, prices are only up, and I was just looking out of Chicago, about 2% year over year. That's not too bad, but the real bargain is into Europe right now. Prices down 25 to 26% out of Chicago, and this is for summertime travel. I was just looking in the second week in June. This is places, one-stop flights, essentially, in some cases, some nonstop flights. Paris, under $600 round trip. You have places like Amsterdam, under $740 round trip. Rome in the $880 range round trip, all those prices down 20 to 23%. And the dollar is extremely strong in many of those destinations. So your activities, lodging, anything that you do there is very inexpensive.
You answered one of my next questions, and that is how early is it? Is it too early to start booking for summer? You mentioned early June. Anything past that? Is it too early still?
You typically, for international long-haul travel, you're going to look at about 5.5 months before departure when you need to start shopping, buy your ticket, no later than about 3 months before. For domestic, start shopping about 3 months out. 3.5 months is when airlines start to manage their cheaper seats, and try not to buy inside of 30 days before departure. You're playing right into airlines' hands if you're waiting to the last minute.
How can we avoid playing into airlines' hands in other cases as well, just for domestic flights? What are those dates that we need to know?
A couple different ones, right? So you have mid-May when prices tend to jump slightly, and then you have also mid-June or the second week in June when prices jump. Also, you see the prices drop dramatically for the last week of August once summer rates kick in. During the year, there's a couple of deal zones. Fall is really the best time to fly, but you have like the first couple weeks in December, which are probably the cheapest 2 weeks to fly throughout the year. You have a large range of dates sort of after the third week in August all the way up until Thanksgiving, where you're going to see rates spike at least for that week of travel. But essentially, if you can fly on the cheapest days, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Saturday, buy your tickets ahead of time, stay off the beaten path. Clearly, the airlines know exactly when everybody's spring break is. They know where everybody wants to go when they get out of the first week of school. They know they want to head to Orlando. If you can stay away from the days that everybody's flying on, you'll also save some money as well.
And what would be a good alternative vacation other than those Florida vacations in spring?
Well, you know, if you're looking this spring, you can have some cold weather options if you're willing to go a little bit cold. It's a little bit chillier, but Canada is about 15% cheaper than it was last year. Also, the Northeast, places like Washington, D.C., are interesting places to visit that time of year. Lots of interesting things going on as you get into spring. Also, right now we're seeing prices drop for the Mexico beach destinations. For obvious reasons, with some issues, that political issues that have been out there and have spurred some changes there. So, look, there's lots of interesting places to fly into. Southern California, Los Angeles, running about $100 cheaper than San Diego, for example. So there's tons of places you can go, both warm and cold.
I know a lot of people have been poo-pooing these basic economy flights, but, Rick, I know somebody who recently did a United flight at the last minute and under $100. For a weekend getaway. It was amazing.
Look, yeah, for a weekend getaway where you can actually take your backpack and put it under the seat and don't have to put a rollerboard on, these are great prices. I don't poo-poo these prices at all. The only thing is that you have to be really careful. It's the same with Spirit Airlines and Frontier. Many of these things, you need to know the rules ahead of time. You don't want to be up at the airport getting penalized, for example, for taking your rollerboard up to the gate in some cases, or paying double to actually check your bag because you didn't do it ahead of time online. So it's just important that you know the rules of these fares.
You mentioned earlier some of those cheap fares out of Chicago that you're seeing. Are you seeing any other deals?
Oh, look, I mean, Chicago is the second cheapest city in the nation to fly out of right now. And so I was just looking, for example, in early June, South Florida, Miami, $200 round trip. You also have Los Angeles at $170 round trip. You can also zip into Portland for $145 round trip in the summertime. Beautiful place to visit. You've got Boston as well at $140 round trip. And then some of the Canadian destinations in early June, Montreal, Quebec, all under $300 round trip. Last year, $380 round trip. So it's really, it's a nice suite of pretty interesting pricing all throughout the country. Cancun, for example, in early June, $250 round trip, which is about 10% less than it was last year.
Rick, now you got me itching to go someplace.
I hope so. This will be a great year to travel. Price is pretty flat domestically and definitely down for international and Caribbean travel.
All right, Rick, happy travels.
Hey, great. Thanks, Steve.
Rick Saini is the founder and CEO of FareCompare.com. You can follow FareCompare at FareCompare on Twitter and Rick Saini at Rick Saini.
You're listening to the opening bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. Dow Futures pointing positive this morning, up about 22 on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. All the other futures pointing up as well. Time for agriculture and commodity. And good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Well, good morning, young man. Always time for agriculture because we have to eat before we do anything else. So that's what we're doing this morning. And as we looked at some of the activity this week in the marketplace, we saw livestock cattle futures ending firmer. Hogs mainly trading lower in yesterday's trade. And then looking at the grain market, interesting happening there, Steve, the fact that wheat and the world is a flood with wheat. We have wheat all over the world, but we hit a seven-month high yesterday after the February crop report showing that U.S. data was going in the favor of a stronger market. Soybeans turned a little bit lower yesterday, but As far as livestock is concerned, February cattle ended the day with a gain of 92 cents and March feeder cattle at $1.32 higher. That's per hundredweight. February lean hogs a penny higher at 74.22. And the grain market yesterday, soybeans took a fairly heavy hit, down 9 cents in the March contract. March corn was down 2 cents, but that wheat contract up 10 cents a bushel in yesterday's trade.
Orion, as we get still watching the Trump administration roll out here, we're still not hearing quite a bit about agriculture.
No, we're not, but the secretary is in Washington. He's meeting with members of the House and Senate Ag Committees to sort of get their parameters set on what they're going to be looking at. The one thing, Steve, is that agricultural legislation, farm bill particularly, pretty much still a bipartisan event in Washington. Their politics does not play quite the role it does in banking and other economic sectors because we have to eat. And so we need the food production. And that's why this week, talking to Chairman of the House Ag Committee, Mike Conaway, he said his goal is to have the farm bill written by the end of this year. And that's something that hasn't happened probably for 15 to 20 years where we have been able to meet the deadline of getting a farm bill written.
Yeah, it's one of those things, too, where we're unlikely to see executive orders about anything related to agriculture.
At this point, that's correct. The one other thing I want to mention, this weekend, this morning, we'll be heading for Greenville, South Carolina. The Outstanding Young Farmer Awards Congress, been going on for, well, I think 60 years now. I've been involved in it almost that long. And the nation's 10 finalists are in the final days of judging, and tomorrow night I'll be emceeing the banquet where we name the nation's 4 outstanding young farmers for the current year.
Sounds exciting. Have safe travels. We'll talk to you again next week.
Okay, Steve.
All right. Bye-bye. Orion Samuelson with us this morning. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for this Friday, February 10th. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics will publish import and export prices for January 2017. Treasury also releases federal budget today. The University of Michigan Sentiment Index for February set to be released as well. This is a preliminary reading, later updated as the month progresses. The January sentiment reading was the highest in the last 12 years and marked a slight uptick from December. Renault, the car company, has its earnings today. President Trump meets with the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, already driving markets around the world, especially in Asia. Automotive trade will be high on the agenda. And Media Day at the Chicago Auto Show continues today. The show officially opens to the public this weekend.